my HMI teaching class, and I'll talk more about that as we go. This is what I do for my research, and it's what I do for my teaching. So for 21 years, I've been here. So this class, and then I teach another class called Real-Time Digital Signal Processing. It's a junior-senior course, and that is every semester. And then I teach this one. I haven't taught this one since last two summers ago. Summer 2016, last time I taught this class. As I mentioned in Canvas, this would be very different for me. So this, I decided to do something different than I'd ever done before. Change textbook, change style. Had plenty of good student feedback and good ratings, certainly in the other versions of the class, but a general criticism of both books I had tried to use. So we're going with a very different approach than traditional textbooks for this class, and this is the signal processing first. So that's this particular book here. So we'll talk more about that as we go. So in this presentation, this is right from the Canvas site. It's also on my website. So two different ways to get the information. And when you know it, I couldn't get Wi-Fi in my life just now. But so there are two different ways. Everyone connecting okay?
I couldn't get on.
I think we do something. Okay. So that's good. So there are two different ways. I have my website and all the same materials also on Canvas. So if one of them is down, you can always go to the other one, because that can happen. On the Canvas site, what will be unique would be your grades and any electronic submission of Canvas. We'll talk about that. So that will go to the Canvas site. But in terms of lecture slides and handouts, both sites have equivalent information, same information. So I also give you the course descriptor, and I've got a lot of this stuff on slides, so we'll go through that. And also, please feel free to fire away questions anytime. Raise your hand or not, I'm flexible on that one. So whatever's comfortable for you. Okay, so first thing up, my research is very much applying what we're going to talk about. And in fact, I'll bring what I've been doing in research into the class, which I'll talk about next. So one thing I've asked you to do also to make this experience and lecture a little more interactive is to bring with you your laptops, which most have done, and have MATLAB installed. So we'll use MATLAB today, and we'll use it pretty much every lecture. I'll have MATLAB code, which explains or demonstrates the concept we're talking about in every set of lecture slides. So the figures that you see, I give you the MATLAB code to generate. Okay, so you can copy and paste from the PowerPoint slides to regenerate what we have in lecture. So I've gone through where I have it on the slides, whatever's in the book. If I borrow a figure, which I will tell you because I'll say copyright by the authors on the signal processing first book, I'll have also the MATLAB code for that. So you can play around with it and try different settings to see what happens. Okay, we'll talk about why MATLAB is important in just a second. That's on the next slide. All right, so I've been here doing research in communication systems and image and video processing. I do some, occasionally I'll go off and do other things. I've been working in networking and some work in GPS systems, signal processing to improve accuracy and also to prevent spoofing. That is to say, someone pretending that they're a GPS satellite to throw you off course or throw off your navigation or timing. And that is a big problem. GPS is easily fooled. So that was a very interesting strand of research. Okay, so I'll talk about this in the next slide, actually, more than the next two. My office hours will be right after class. Luckily, we're all in the same building. This is wonderful. After 3 years of exile into different parts of the campus, it's been great. And so I'll have office hours only for this class. Okay, so my other class is Monday, Wednesday, Friday morning office hours. So please respect those hours for the other class I'm teaching. Yeah. For this class, it's only for you, Tuesday, Thursday, right after class. It'll be up on the sixth floor. And then I have coffee hours, which I've had for 15 years. The location has changed, the time has not. So Friday, 12 to 2, alumni come back and find me. They send me an email, okay, where are you having your coffee hours? So we'll reconnect. So when you come back, please find me for my coffee hours. Now you'll know we're going to be in this building a long time, so you know where to find me on Fridays 12 to 2. So the coffee hours are for anything. Advising, classes to take, got an interview coming up, what do I put on my resume, can you look at my resume, let's talk about grad school options, summer research opportunities, lots of them. So any of those kind of questions, that's great for the coffee hours. And for the office hours, kind of class-related questions. Unless the time permits to handle other things. But usually the office hours are for kind of class questions. So here's a couple of things that I've worked on. There's certainly a space station. Can't tell you know what that is. And then a lot of work in different versions of wired modems, DSL, and other things. We'll talk about that in a second. The TA for the class will be Anisha Ghosh. Anisha's here somewhere.
I'm here.
Okay. Are you recording the audio?
Yes.
Good. So we have a couple, at least one student who couldn't make it due to Hurricane Harvey and just whatever. So we're going to record for that student today. Make it available. Okay, so I'm on slide two. So Ms. Ghosh will have office hours certainly Tuesday, Thursday, right before class. And the Wednesday hours may change, but I'll let you know what they are. And then where they are is important. We still don't know that. It's a new building. We're still trying to figure out what to do. It turns out there are TA office spaces. They just haven't been finished yet. They're on floor zero, and they're still under construction. So we're going to find some other space for the TAs to hold their office hours. So the good news is in January, we'll have standard TA offices. And then just for this semester, we'll have to find a temporary solution, mostly in this building, but maybe ECJ and some other, you know, close by buildings. Okay, so it'll be Tuesday, Thursday, right before class. I'll have my office hours right after class. Her office hours will shift into the morning. I'll let you know what they are when we figure that out. And homework is due on Friday, okay, 12:30, by Canvas submission, electronic submission. So that's another reason why my office hours after class on Thursday may be quite useful if you have homework questions for the homework due the next day. Okay, there's a lot of stuff on this next slide. So these are the projects that are, it's not all the projects, but it's a pretty good selection of them. These are the different projects I've worked on. There's a lot of stuff here on the slide. So I'll break it up. So the first three rows are communication systems, one form or another. The next one, even the fourth one, the first three are consumer electronics, stuff you would use in your daily life for wireless communication and wired, both. The next one is underwater communications. This is an interesting idea. How do you send data underwater? You have a sensor network monitoring, you know, sea life or levels of certain chemicals in the ocean. Well, how do you transmit that information back? There are also military applications for teams of divers and so forth. So we send that information through by acoustic waves underwater for longer distance transmission. You can certainly send electromagnetic waves. You can send light, but only for short distances. And it's scattered into light, and electromagnetic waves have really high attenuation. They can't go very far underwater. So for distance, tend to go with acoustic waves, just sound. So we just played stuff over a speaker, just an underwater speaker, if you would, listening to music. So we just did it over the same band, just sound underwater. The next two rows are image and video processing applications. I tend to work both in the image acquisition, take a picture, take a video, and also print or display it. Display it on your cell phone, display it on a laptop, or print it. Okay, so there are a lot of signal processing opportunities here to improve the quality of the image or video that you're acquiring with your smartphone or still camera. And there's also opportunities to make it high quality when you display it or print it. So we've worked on both of those topics. Also work on some design tools to say, well, these are all really nice, you know, algorithms, but how do I get into a system? How do I incorporate into a larger, more complicated system? And that's this last row, which I give you one of the things we've done. So most of it's algorithm development, except for the last row, four applications. Applications include, again, communication systems, acoustic or audio communication in the water case, and image and video processing. So throughout the semester, I'll have demos on these different applications. I also love audio. You know, the reason I came to Austin, besides UT, which is a great place to be and glad to be here, was in high school, two things. One is watching Austin City Limits at the time I was in South Carolina, and the musicians coming out of Austin. And for that time period, it was Stevie Ray Vaughan. That's what got me here to Austin, those two things. So it took me 13 more years to get here, but I eventually got here. I tried other jobs. I tried an interview and a job in 93 in the middle of a recession. There was no opening, but I went ahead and visited Summers Day Labs, which were out on 620. With the recession, no opportunity opened up. But then 96, I interviewed for this job and got it. So glad to be in Austin. Also a bike-friendly town, so you'll see me biking around, commuting to work. Feel free to wait. Be nice to me on the road. So back to the research project. So the contributions that we did is the second column, and that's all nice. But what I think what's relevant for this class is, well, okay, so how did we, what was the design process like? Because ultimately what my research group did is look at a problem that industry was trying to solve 3 to 4 years out, come up with some good algorithms for this, and then go ahead and map it down to an embedded platform as a prototype. Now, we don't make products generally in the university, but at least we have a prototype of what could become a product. And then companies can take it from there because they have lots of expertise and people and processes in place to make it a product that we just don't have, you know, that kind of scale here. So that was kind of, so we looked at it, so that which you'll see is the simulation of the algorithms was almost entirely in MATLAB. And a few exceptions, so there's a LabVIEW in there, and there's Linux and C++ down here for design tools, but for the algorithm development, it's all MATLAB except one case. It turns out LabVIEW has it's a national service tool, and I'm based in Austin. It has a version of MATLAB called MathScript. And so even there, you can use MATLAB syntax and code in the design. And you can even map it to an embedded platform from MATLAB, which is interesting. You'll have to go to see, and it's an intermediate language. But for anything that's high performance or high throughput, that's where you're going to need something like C or custom hardware or both to make something work in real time. So that's the second to the last column under prototype is, well, what hardware platform do we ultimately use in the prototype to make it work in real time and show feasibility of the idea? And then funding from different companies, that kind of just shows you a couple things, which companies were interested in this kind of work. So that's kind of a good list of companies that this class is interesting to you. Maybe this is worth talking to some of the companies about opportunities, if this is interesting to you. It also tells you, you know, what has contributed funding to my research group. So it gives you probably some, you know, where my connections are as well, where I've connected and where some of, you know, the graduate students who worked on this, some went to the sponsoring companies and some did not. So it's an ongoing relationship with some of these today. So I still have funding from Huawei and National Instruments today from this list, but not from the others directly. And indirectly, there's funding through our wireless center from Qualcomm. That's it on the list up there. And I also still have funding from IBM and NXP and TI. Okay. So for this class, we're going to do application theory, and we're going to simulate it in MATLAB. And there's a couple different ways to think about this. One is, yeah, we're going to have to do some math. We're going to use calculus and use what you've seen already, sinusoids, phasors, and all that. But that math won't be in a vacuum. That math will be intended to tackle an application. And for the first 6 lectures, audio will be our primary application. So speech processing, speech generations, and audio, music, tone, sinusoids. And as we go forward in the class, we'll also do image and video processing in addition to audio as our motivating application. Any questions on this one? Stuff on this one? So this class will not give you, is a starting point into these kind of application spaces. So if this class is interesting to you, there are many classes to take after this one. Signal processing theory, there's an image and video processing class. There are embedded systems classes, 445L, 445M, the video classes, 371R, the visual processing class is 351M, so lots of options beyond this class. On implementation technology, this is 460M, as a Merriam remark for the FPGA implementation. You see a little bit of this in 316, digital logic design. 319K, to start off the embedded system work. Who's in 319K now? Curious. Who already had 319K? That was last year. Very good. 411 was last, whatever, some previous semester.
That's a prerequisite for circuit board.
Okay, so there'll be some things that you'll see in here that relate to your experience in the 319 case. So in the back of your mind, think about, yeah, you know, ultimately we'd like to implement this on a platform. So it could be smartphone platform as an app, or it could be a more deeply embedded component in a system. Not the application processor, but something that controls a peripheral audio subsystem, for example, for audio playback. Okay, so let's go ahead and kind of go through some of the definitions we'll use in the class. And, you know, these are not meant to be exhaustive, but just kind of gives us some insight. So the title of the class is Linear Systems and Signals. So I've got to, you know, unpack some terms here. And the usage here might be a little bit different from what you had in previous classes. It might be similar, it might be a little bit more expanded, maybe more abstract. So what signals have you seen so far from your previous classes? Give me some examples. Go ahead.
Clock signals.
Oh, by the way, lights on or off, that's, I should check this for your preference. So how visible is that back row? You're good? We're good. Okay, so an example is a clock signal. Have an example of that in a couple slides. Right? So this is something that you can think of as either ticking at a certain rate, so I can think of it as a discrete clicks, or I can think of it as something that's continuous time, on off. And so a couple ways I can think about that. So I can think about it as, you know, on off, and of course it's really, the clock signal is usually not always exactly, there's more possibilities than on or off. But an abstract sense would be, okay, I have some sort of on-off clocking. Rising and falling. Okay, so the clock signal, here we have just something that's rectangular. It could be sinusoidal. Some clock signals are that way. They can be rectified. So you can send the cosine through a equivalent of a squaring device. So we'll talk about all these. These things will come very soon as examples. Okay, so here's an example clock signal. And this is an on half the time the way I have it, and on half the time as I've drawn it. Any other signals you've seen? Circuit theory, what were your signals? Measuring what? Did some function of time, it measured voltage or current, right? So that was circuit theory. So it could be a voltage signal. In fact, this clock signal could all likely be a voltage signal. So it could be a voltage signal, so it'd be voltage versus time. It could be current versus time. For taking notes, if you've got, you know, PDF annotation tools, that might be useful to generate PDF from the PowerPoint or annotate the PowerPoint directly, whatever works for you. Now, there are lots of other signals that maybe you haven't explicitly dealt with, but you use all the time. So audio is another example of a signal. So you have some voltage varying with time, and you play that over the speakers, an audio signal, and it gets converted to acoustic waves, and you hear that. It goes through your earphones, either way, or headphones. So the signal is going to be current information, and it's going to have patterns of variations that represent a physical quantity. So it could be voltage, it could be current, it could be all kinds of things, it could be temperature, lots of things. So here's one example. Here is measurements of temperature as a function of the day. So the day, this is 1 month. This is September of 2016. And the days are numbered on the horizontal axis. So one through whatever, okay, to the end of the month. And the degrees in Fahrenheit are on the vertical axis. That's a signal. Discrete in time. So we're just measuring each day independently. So the horizontal axis is discrete, not continuance. Now, this one I liked a lot. Now, this one I pulled, and I really liked. This is in Austin, so we had a little bit of rain over the summer. So this is the SR, this is the Stewart Vaughan statute, which came out in here. It's just an interesting view. And so you can think of this as an image. So it is an image. So as an image, it's a signal. And I can think of it in horizontal and vertical terms. So at every point in that image, I have an intensity. And it's either, if it's a gray level image, it measures simply monochrome, extremes between black and white. If it's color, then I have a red and green and a blue at each pixel. And I can represent this image as a matrix of discrete values as well. Okay, so here we're getting the patterns of variations in the image is light. Right, it's the intensity of light that impinges or falls on a receiver array, some photo array in the camera. All right, so signal processing was, this is lots of definitions for signal processing, and it's one of these terms that gets redefined often. At some point, it's always going to be around because we redefine it. But here are some working definitions from the IEEE Signal Processing Society. It involves extraction of information, algorithms associated with architectures and implementations and applications. Pretty large definition here. So again, we're generating signals, we're going to be transforming them, so converting them from one form to another. So a good example of that. Well, let's go to generation. What's a good example of generating a signal? How do I generate a clock signal?
Use an oscillator.
Yeah, so I have to build the right circuitry for that. So it could be self-ringing or some other circuit for that. Transformation. How do I transform one signal into another? Give me an example of that. Absolutely. So you have an analog to digital converter. You have analog in, digital out. And then once you have a digital representation, it's digital and discrete time. You can process that by computer and digital hardware quite easily. So this is an example of this might be audio, right? You're singing into a microphone. The microphone's converting the sound waves into voltage and current. That goes through an analog to digital converter. And out comes a representation that you can then do additional processing on, or record it, or whatever you want to do, stream it. Right, so there's a lot of stuff in the microphone. There'll be a transducer that converts the pressure waves into current and voltage, continuous time analog, and then we can take it from there through an A to D converter. So do you give any? So we have take a microphone. So I get pressure waves that come in. To a voltage signal. That voltage signal then is carried. This could be carried off the microphone or converted into the microphone. So there are digital microphones that output a digital discrete time stream. All the processing, all the conversion is actually in the microphone. Other microphones, it's an analog out. So it depends on the microphone. So the microphone here gives us an analog out. We then send it through an analog to digital converter. To get now a discrete time signal. So it started out as something that was varying with time going into the analog digital converter, now comes out as being indexed as samples, and we'll spend a little more effort on what that means in just a second, mathematically. But so again, I have a voltage signal that comes in to the A to D converter. It varies, it's both continuous time and analog and amplitude, goes through an A to D converter. What comes out is a signal that's represented by, say, capital V bits per sample, and I index each sample by this index. So in 319K, in the Intro to Embedded Systems class, you dealt with this, right? You brought signals in from the outside, of the board, and you converted them through an NDD converter, and you did some work with them on your embedded processor. So that's a good example of a transformation taking one signal to another. And sometimes, so there's algorithms that are involved here, or circuit design, as the case may be, for the A-to-D converter. Extract information, so an example of this, you're talking, and you've got speech recognition on, you're dictating whatever. So you're speaking, usually naturally, hopefully. Sometimes you might have to slow it down, depends on how good the speech recognition is. And that will extract the actual text of your speech for email or whatever you need, text. Okay, so that's another way of extracting information. So signal processing also involves the algorithms associated with not just the application space, audio, video, whatever, but also how you implement this on a particular implementation platform. It could be laptop software, it could be embedded software, it could be embedded hardware, and of course applications. Now the system, and I used, we had transformation up there, and so transformation, the way I drew it on the board, again, the transformation here is done with an A-to-D converter. This is going to be your system. Okay, so we've kind of, you know, transformation is kind of hard to do without something transforming it. That's going to be typically a system. So the system is going to manipulate change. It can record, it can transmit signals. Right? So the A-to-D converter is a good way to change a signal from one representation to another. It is a transformation. We can certainly record something onto memory. We can convert one signal into another. So here's some examples of systems. So we can have a bunch of audio signals in, mix it. We have, you know, the output from a microphone, output from a guitar, output from other instruments, bring them to a mixing board, decide how much gain you want on each channel, and combine them. You can also add effects, sound effects and so forth. And then the output of that would feed speakers. Could be an embedded, you know, camera, could be a Wi-Fi access point. So all these are lots of signal processing happening in all these products. Okay, so let's do kind of with those kind of definitions in mind, let's think about objectives for the class. And yeah, there are more than two, but I wanted to distill it down into something, a shorter list that kind of encompasses what this class will do. So first thing is to understand mathematical descriptions of signal processing algorithms. How do you describe the conversion of a signal from continuous time analog to discrete time digital? So we'll talk about that a lot even in the first six lectures. What's the math that underlies that? And then express those algorithms as software implementations for simulation. So we're not going to do embedded implementation in the class. That's some other classes to do that. If you want to do both in one class, it's the real-time digital signal processing lab class that I teach. Okay, so here's the first MATLAB program to look at. And we'll come back. So I'll give you an intro to MATLAB in a few slides, and we'll come back to this. But just to kind of throw up the idea of what the code looks like, we'll come back and parse it out in a little bit. So this is just a cosine. It's a function of time. And the frequency of the cosine is 440 hertz. I'm going to use this a lot. The book uses it a lot. What note is that in the Western scale? That's A, right? In which octave? I always had to look that one up too. That's what I don't.
Is it three?
I hear three, I hear second, I hear four. Right, so hold that thought. We'll see that in a bit. I'll lay out the piano keyboard in a bit. Okay. But it is an A note. It's on the keyboard. It's on a piano keyboard. The piano goes down to 27.5 hertz. And up to like 4180 or something, 86 hertz. So it spans quite a bit. Those are just the tones, not the harmonics, but the principal frequency when you hit the key. All right, so this is on the piano keyboard, somewhere close to the middle. Okay, so this is just plotting this as a function of time. And this is the kind of thing we'll understand for, you know, this is a very simple mathematical description. But it has a lot of meaning, and we'll use other descriptions. It's a very simple example of one, which is a time-varying cosine, or cosine that varies with time, but at a fixed frequency, 440 hertz. Okay, so what I wanted to ask you is maybe some objectives to take the class. So why are you taking this class? I think I know the answer. Because you have to. All right, it's required. Okay. All right, so it's required. So, you know, I think it's a great class. I think this is an incredibly interesting material. So, yeah, okay, it's required. But now let's talk beyond that. Now that you're in here, what objectives do you have? What would you like to get out of the class? Go ahead.
Learn more about, like, audio processing and being in the self-organization.
Okay. Blue visible back row? Are we good? Okay. All right, so more about audio, music. Maybe a mathematical, you see it, a mathematical?
Yeah, is it mathematical or science?
So I heard design, description of music. It is. Where might it be applied? You don't have to answer. So where might Fourier analysis get applied? It may not be something you've seen. You've seen Fourier series, I think, in differential equations. Is that?
Converting from like time to frequency.
So converting from time to frequency. Excellent. Now, you don't have to answer this one. Someone else can. You can if you like. Why is that important?
It can help you filter out noise in a signal.
It can help you filter out noise. So if you know if you know something about the frequency content of the signal you care about, you can then apply a filter to pass those frequencies you care about and try to reduce the ones you don't care about. And that will help you reduce noise and other interference sources and get a better signal quality as a result. So it's one way. It's absolutely. Any other use of converting from time to frequency? So filtering was one. Go ahead.
Sometimes the math is better than
the Sometimes the math is better. That's exactly right. Sometimes the math is incredibly easy. The time domain looks like it's a mess and the integrals are unforgiving. And they have time in the integral, and you're just going, really? Why is it a number? This is coming later in convolution, just to let you know, this is later. And you find out, you know, if I just hit it with the right transform, it's a product, and I'm done. There's two lines of math instead of a page of confusing integrals. So sometimes the math is incredibly simplified by going to the frequency domain. Sometimes. Now, sometimes the opposite is true. You're in the frequency domain, and you're going, this is really intractable. So you switch to the time domain where it's easier. So part of the class will be, okay, which domain is easier to work in? Absolutely. So I got filtering. Easier math. Excellent. So that's great. And there's more to the story. But so anyway, there's this lot. It's another way to think about the signal or the system you're analyzing or designing. Gives you another dimension into the problem solution. Okay. Excellent. Any other objectives of this semester? Yeah. So is this? So is signal processing of interest? To me, that's right. Well, of course. is that I hope it is. But what I will say is, no matter what you specialize in, having some understanding of this topic would be very, very helpful. And you use information from this class all the time through your day. It may have, it's implicit, but we'll make it explicit where it shows up. Just to plot plot data, you've got to sample it. And that's going to be our first big topic this semester. Is how do I sample something? How do I choose? How many samples do I take? What's the guidance to do this? Maybe you have seen the sampling theorem already, but we'll go in more depth. We'll talk about it and go into more depth about it. Ricard textbook, signal processing first. It's 2003, pretty proven book. Now the good news on this is it was good in 2003 and it's still good, and a couple reasons for this. First, the authors are really good at this stuff, all right? So the founder of the field of digital signal processing is Ron Schaefer. He's a professor at Georgia Tech for many years until he retired. He's now out in the Bay Area, teaches occasionally at Stanford. So he has a son is out there, like one of the reasons he moved out here, and grandchild. All right, Jim McClellan is still at Georgia Tech. Mark Yoder's at Rose Holman, where I went to undergraduate school. So I know them very well, and they're very good at this stuff. So McClellan's name you would see in other classes. He has some very famous stuff named after him, both of them in filter design. So you'll see that if you take anything beyond this class. Mark Yoder's an incredible educator. So first of all, they really know the field. That's a good sign. Number two, they tested this material for 10 years before the book came out, so that's a good thing. This is the second book. The first book came out in 95, called Digital Signal Processing First, or DSP First. And they came up with a second edition for DSP First in 2015. So they've continued developing the material, and they're still teaching out of the book. So they have updated, they update the demos and materials all the time on this website. So the MATLAB code is up to date, the demos are in modern format. So this is an ongoing development. Even though the book is 2003 and very solid, technically the demos and MATLAB are continuing in development and updating over time. And they're still teaching this at both institutions. At Georgia Tech, it is like it is here. It's in the second year of the curriculum. And you may take it in your third year, that's fine. But it's in the second year of the curriculum. So please get the book. And again, and please visit the website, because the website is laid out very nicely per chapter. So every chapter has demos. They also have their own lecture slides. And when I borrow from them, you'll see me annotated with a copyright on the slide. Okay, so let's get on to some more logistics here to move along. So I've taught this class a lot, and I normally do it in the 50-minute lecture format. And if you had noticed, that was my initial section. But for other reasons, I ended up shifting to Tuesday, Thursday. Okay, so it's a 75-minute lecture, which means we got to do something about that. Right? It's tough to stay focused. So part of what we'll do is on Tuesdays, we'll have some interactive exercises where you'll either write usually a little bit of MATLAB, and I'll give you the template, play around a little bit, and then submit what you did. And that'll be on Tuesday. So I'm calling that the Tune-Up Tuesdays, because I know what happens otherwise. It's Thursday night, and the homework is due. And you're panicking, and then I'm panicking, and the TA is panicking. So my hope is that we want to reduce the panic. I'm not saying the panic will be gone, but we want to reduce the panic. So one way to reduce the panic is to have something on Tuesday to get you ready for the homework. So whatever we do on Tuesday will prepare you for the homework due on Friday. So two midterm exams, a final exam, and the exact dates are in the syllabus that I handed to you, the course description. So that's in the printed form. So we're on slide 6. But just to be, so I've already in Canvas laid out all the, everything. Right? So if you go to Canvas, to the calendar, every thing that's due is there. All right, so you can just go. So the midterm one is on Thursday, October 5th in class. We'll get a bigger room because it'll be open book, open note, open laptop. No networking. You can't have internet going. Gotta disable, you know, gotta have something here. Make sure it's your own work. Midterm two is November 16th, Thursday in class. And the final exams, it's a little late, but I don't control these things. It's Monday, December 18th at 9 a.m. Okay, cutoffs, you know, this is what tends to work fine for these cutoffs. So these are what I'll use. And so 90 is an A. I know some classes, 193 is an A. I don't understand that one. 90 is an A, and there'll be some curving of the exams as well. So anyway, this is the rough, you know, breakdown. So basically every one-third, so 86.67 is an A minus, and 83.34 is a B plus, and so forth. There are nine homework assignments. You get to drop the lowest one. There are these Tune-Up Tuesdays, you get to drop the lowest one of that. Okay, so stuff happens, you can't make it, and not a problem. So if it's not an excused absence, you get to drop it. What are the excused absences at UT? What's the one thing you get? There's only one. Can I give that away? What's the one excused absence at UT?
Religious holiday.
Not athletics, religious holiday. Athletics, I give remote exams. So if you're away at an athletic event, I'll send the exam to an athletic coach and they'll take it while the other students are taking it. Works fine. So whatever the UT, if this happens, whatever the UT thing is, whatever the UT event is, it takes you off campus, just take it remotely with a proctor from UT. Okay, so let me know if you've got a religious, just let me, not in class, but separately, let me know if you have need a religious exemption from, you know, for this semester. Now, other thing, now that's what the university says, but clearly there are other reasons to get an excused absence, even though nothing else is covered. But clearly, natural disaster, we're just going through, or you're in the hospital, so clearly I'll make arrangements, whatever is happening, beyond the religious, you know, mandatory observance of a religious holiday. Okay. But for other things, you can drop, you know, you get to drop stuff, so that's kind of nice. All right, so midterm and final exams, well, based on the lecture that I'll do, discussions that we have, open book, open note, open computer, no network connections, no smartphones, it'll be off, no headphones, even though we use them in lecture. Lots of little exams online and reader. Now the thing is, since I'm changing the order of topics, I'll have to guide you on which problems on which midterms make sense. Because the book changes the order of things. It places the most difficult concept instead of the first. So and usually in this class, the most difficult concept, in my opinion, is the first thing you do, which is called convolution. And there's this great panic among everybody. This book is better. Convolutions in the second midterm, not the first. So you build up a lot of momentum going into convolution. And you also have frequency tools at your dispense to make it easier. You can shift to the frequency to make out some of them and make it really easy. Okay. Slide 7. All right, so grading. So the homework series, we'll be modeling signals and systems. There'll be some MATLAB code as part of that. Certainly no problem working in groups to discuss the questions, but when you turn in a homework solution, make sure it's your own independent solution. Okay? So it should be yours. So it's okay to work in a group to a point, discussing the problem and methodology to solve it, approaches to solve the problem. Helping debug each other's MATLAB code is fine, but just don't borrow someone else's MATLAB. Usual stuff for independent solution. Now, the Tune-Up Tuesdays, you do that here in the lecture and just submit on campus. That week, that would come Friday, Tuesday. Again, that hopefully reduces the Thursday night panic. And many projects we'll do in groups. Okay, so we'll do two of those in place of homework. So there'll be some weeks where there's no homework. Do a main project. So be MATLAB, so MATLAB code, you do it with a partner. So there's only two of back to percentages, these are still relatively small percentages. So homework is, you know, you drop one, so there are 8 of them, so 2% each homework. Tune up Tuesday, there are 12 of them, so that's like 0.3, or one third of a percentage. Pretty minor, too many projects, 4% each. So my intent of the mini project is not to be more involved in a homework assignment. But we're going to go, but you'll do one thing, one application for that project. So that's why I'm calling it a mini project. Whereas homework might be 3 questions, the mini project will be one topic where you go a little bit deeper into it. Be an application. Any questions on this? Is logistics are important. I'm very sensitive on workload, so if you look at the workload ratings on the courses, do you look at the course instructor surveys that you fill out? Do you ever go back and look at what you did or wrote? Or does anyone ever go back to look at course instructor surveys? Okay, good, there's one. So we have all this data going back to 2005, including workload ratings. So you can find out how much work a professor requires in a certain class. So in my other class in real-time DSP, my workload rating is lower than the department average, 3.15 out of 3.38. So I'm very sensitive to workload. So if this workload starts to get too high, I will scale it back. Because I'm trying something new and I don't want to overload you. So I've learned over many years not to assign too many problems on a homework, assign it a week in advance, give you time to sort through it, and we'll scale back. If some question is totally unreasonable, we'll scale it back. On a homework assignment. Okay, if you're thinking about applying to grad school a little later, I hope you are. And I hope everyone goes to grad school in something. Law, medicine, MBA, engineering, whatever it happens to be, psychology. I know we have one of our excellent students go off in government. Excellent graduate work in government. Whatever it is. Go, at some point, go get a graduate degree. If you are seeking a recommendation, what I tend to put in the recommendations a little bit later is how you did in the class in terms of classroom. And again, for a lot of graduate schools, you want to match kind of your profile with the graduate school profile. And you know, if you're in the top half of the class, probably that would be fine for a recommendation in many graduate schools. So if you go to a more competitive graduate school, like an MIT, a Berkeley, Stanford, or even our own, probably a little higher rank than that, right? Top 20%, top 15%. So if you want to add a recommendation, I'm always by the right one. But just to let you know, our goal is to provide information that a graduate admissions committee can't get any other way. And one example of that is the course rank. It's not on your transcript. The letter grade is, but not the rank in the class. Okay, so just keep that in mind. And so going to grad school, you do need 3 recommendations. So it just means in 3 of your classes, you find that the 3 classes you did the best in and ask that professor for a recommendation. So it might be this one, it might be another one, but you're taking 20 EE classes roughly when you add everything up. So you just pick, you know, the best 3 that you did out of the 20 for your grad school application. And if it's in a non-engineering field or non-computer science, then you might think about other professors, and if you're going on MBA, you probably want someone for business and such. Okay, now where this class fits in is another thing to be aware of. So this class has a crazy role in the curriculum. It is a prerequisite for 27 other classes in our curriculum, both on the electrical engineering side and the computer engineering. So here is one heck of a slide, slide 8, on the list of all these classes. It's a little bit on the crazy side. So on the communications, networks, and signal processing, kind of from the applications I talked about already, that kind of makes some sense. Okay, data science, machine learning, well, also feeds in. Okay, so the classes that are the arrows here are also needing 313 as a prerequisite. You really use the material in those classes. It doesn't end there. Computer systems, computer architecture, embedded systems. Well, This class is also a prereq, because you're dealing with signal acquisition, sensing, actuation, conditioning, filtering, a lot of stuff from this class in the embedded system side. Electronics integrated circuits. We already talked about analog to digital conversion. That's a circuit design in the end. The input is analog continuous time. The output is digital discrete time. All right, so there's a whole set of circuit classes that build on this material. Not finished. Power, energy systems. A lot of stuff on power quality monitoring, denoising, removing harmonics from switching power supplies, filtering, sinusoidal signals as the basis of power transmission. So there's a lot of classes that this class depends on. So, I mean, it is possible that I suppose you could not take any of these. And I suppose there's still a couple tech areas, tech course you could choose so that you never use this class again. It could happen. So if you really don't like this material, there are some escape routes out of the curriculum. But my hope is you do like the material at least enough to build on it. Maybe you specialize it in it, but at least maybe you build on it in other classes. All right, so let's go on. So that's logistics of things. Now we can switch in the technical content right from the book. But I'm going to pause there. Any questions on logistics of things, courses coming up? So let's go on to some technical topics here. The time that remains. Now again, this is you've dealt with. We already talked about signals as functions on earlier slides. We're on slide 9. This one you've already seen, a little larger now. So this is the same as before. This is the plot of temperature versus day in Austin, September 2016. So the upper plot is discrete time. So that, as I say, the time axis, which is in the horizontal, is discretized, integer, or some finite number of measurements on a continuum of values, not real value. But the plot below, which is the cosine at frequency 440 hertz, is something that's continuous in time. So the horizontal axis is now real valued, and all possible values in the real in the interval here from 0 to 10 milliseconds is possible. And then the amplitude is in the vertical axis, right? So it's just a cosine, so the amplitude varies from minus 1 to 1 inclusive. So again, the top right plot is discrete time, bottom right plot is continuous time. And the MATLAB code is for the upper plot in high temp. Pulled that data from the web and plotted it as a stem plot in MATLAB, but I don't have that one. But we'll do stem plots in a bit. So again, we got continuous time signals lower right, discrete time signal upper right. So again, continuous time signal. Now, here we use time, and it's possible that it could be space. There's lots of variables it could be, but for now it's just time. So again, continuous time, so I have x of t, where t can take any real value. X of t could be 0 for some range of values. Could be finite in extent, but let that extent. Discrete time signals, it's going to be a function of discrete index, little n, or it could be little m. It doesn't matter what the placeholder variable is, but that integer index can be negative or positive or 0. Just like in time, continuous time, time can go back to minus infinity, philosophical, what that means, and it can go ahead to infinity, which is also philosophical. What does that mean? So, but mathematically, we let the time index in principle take any value. Now, we may focus our attention on an interval of time, of course. The amplitude can be real or complex. So in the case of both signals shown on the slide, the amplitudes were in both cases, right? Temperature is measured as a real number to some accuracy, and the cosine is some real number. Even though some of the values may be irrational, we go ahead and round them to a near real number. So with the actual computation for this cosine involves real numbers using the MATLAB code, for example. But you know, so what if it's irrational, it's still real? Doesn't have to be floating point. So I misspoke there a second ago, I realized I may have misspoken. So amplitude value is real value. The real numbers could be floating point, they could be irrational, it doesn't matter. It's real value. And then to compute them, we tend to compute with real numbers, floating point numbers to be precise. Okay, continuous signals, so that was time domain. So it's one of the dimensions to be concerned about. Another dimension is the amplitude. So the amplitude can be also continuous in value. Here's an example. It could be digital in amplitude. So digital here means it takes one of finite value. The amplitude is from a finite set of values. So here it's just two values. We're assuming that the transition from one to minus one is instantaneous, which isn't true in practice. There's always some amount of time it takes to go from one to minus one. It could be nanoseconds, it could be something really small, microseconds, but in practice there always is a delay. But here in the ideal representation, we're assuming an instantaneous transition from one to minus one. So this could be a clock signal, right? One is on and minus one is off, or vice versa. Okay. So I've got, now how would you describe the time axis on the discrete, the digital amplitude plot? Is the time axis discrete or continuous?
Continuous.
All right, so here we have a clock signal that's continuous time, digital amplitude. And that's a little bit strange. So normally we talk about analog signals and we kind of imply that they're continuous time, but it may not be the case. And digital signals may imply to be discrete time, but that may not always be the case. So here we have continuous time. Analog. Here on slide 10. And the slide above, the plot above it, the analog amplitude, what is the time axis? Upper left plot. Continuous time. And analog amplitude. Now it's possible, so what we're looking at now is the third dimension. Things, which is now how do we mathematically represent these signals? If the amplitudes are deterministic, we might be able to come up with a formula, like we had been doing and will continue to do with the cosine. There's an example of cosine of 2 pi f naught t, so the fixed frequency f naught does not change with time. Okay, fine. So that was on the previous page, previous slide. So. There are other situations that we just can't do that. So that is the case where the amplitudes are random. So you can't predict the amplitudes by a formula, but you can predict the probability of different values of the amplitude. So that you can have a formula for. So for example, if I flip a coin 10 times and I plot the measurements, and there's a MATLAB code for that. So here's a trial one. So I go ahead and flip a fair coin 10 times, and I let, let's say 1 be heads and minus 1 be tails. Then I get a certain set of values for each flip number, each time I flip the coin. Now I know what the amplitudes are, because I've run the experiment. But ahead of time, I couldn't have known that. But now, once I've done the measurement, now I can treat this like any other signal and just process it. Now I do know the values. If I ran another trial, flip the coin another 10 times, a different set of answers probably. So I don't know until I run the experiment what the data will be. But I know the probability of what the value, amplitude values could be. Okay, now, in the time axis, is this discrete or continuous in time?
Discrete.
Right, so it's a flipped number. Amplitude, is the amplitude discrete? Sorry, is it digital or amplitude? Sorry, digital or analog for the amplitude?
Digital,
right? It's only two possible values, one and minus. Also some review here from 411 circuit theory, probably differential equations, maybe other stuff, other classes too. So we're gonna make a lot of use of sinusoids. And you kind of already got a heads up on that when I asked for your personal objectives and we talked about Fourier analysis. Fourier analysis converting from time to frequency, and although I didn't say it, also from frequency back to time. You can go either direction. And what that's going to do for us is ultimately we're going to decompose a signal in the time domain into a sum of sinusoids, like you did with the Fourier series. The Fourier series is an example of Fourier analysis. It's one of the primary techniques in Fourier analysis. And in Fourier series, what did you do? You broke a signal, a periodic signal, into what? In Fourier series. How many sinusoids did you use? Could be two, depends on the application of the signal. Could be one, it was just a cosine. What else? What was the largest number of sinusoids you would use in a Fourier series to solve a differential equation? In theory. In practice, you can't get there. But in theory, it's infinity. I gave it away. Now, in practice, we can't, you know, wait for an infinite number of sinusoids to be added together. So in practice, we'll make it finite. Okay, so let's start with a single sinusoid, because we're going to use this over and over and over again. Just to review. Also, on the top of the slide, so we're on slide 11, on top of the slide is the chapter and section number from the book. If I haven't gotten, and that is feedback I get loud and clear on. I've read every evaluation I've ever gotten. And if that isn't the most clear thing I've ever gotten on an evaluation. So here it is. So every slide will be chapter and section from the book. And if I miss one, let me know. Because I make mistakes. So let me know if I missed one. I'll go back and fix it. All right, so here's our mathematical form. So it's just a time. It's a cosine, fixed frequency, amplitude capital A. Frequency omega naught is in radians per second, so it can be written as 2 pi times f naught. F naught's in hertz. So I tend, for a lot of applications, we tend to work with hertz, right? F naught, cycles per second. And then phi is a phase shift in radians. Now the next thing is, well, we know it's periodic, we've talked about periodicity and sinusoids are periodic. And so just as a definition of kind of what that means mathematically, so a signal x of t has a period, capital T, if I take the signal in time and I shift it by capital T, I get back the same signal that I started. And this has, so this formula where x of little t plus capital T is the same as x of t, has to be true for all values of little t time, all little values. Now for the cosine, this is easy to work, somewhat easy to work with, because we know that if we shift the cosine by 2 pi, we get back our cosine. So cosine x plus 2 pi is cosine x. So I can take the definition where I have x of little t plus capital T and plug it into the cosine that I have on the top main bullet here to replace little t with little t plus capital T. So plug it in. Right, so it's using the property of the cosine. So cosine of 2 pi times f naught times the quantity little t plus capital T. Distribute out that multiplication. I get cosine of 2 pi f naught, little t plus 2 pi f naught times capital T. So that's going to be periodic anytime the second term is 2 pi, or a multiple of 2 pi. So we're going to get periodicity whenever 2 pi times little times f naught times the period capital T, whatever the period is, As long as that's 2 pi, we have a period, capital T. So you solve for capital T, divide both sides by 2 pi, and you get capital T is 1 over F naught. Something you've used many times in the past. So here's an example. So again, I have my A note at 440 hertz. F naught is 440 hertz. I invert that, and the period is either the period is 2.27 milliseconds, rounded to recent infinite digits. Okay, so here's the audio for that. So this is one of the reasons to bring, not for what I'm about to do, but if you want to play with some of this stuff, and I'll ask you to do that on Tuesday, just to bring headphones in, just because we're all playing audio stuff, and there's 60 of us. I mean, it's a neat audio effect once, but I think it will be a little bit. Okay, so the MATLAB is, again, it's free for you. We have a site license, so you can download and install it. Got a 2 windows here. The upper window is for writing a script that you can save the file. The bottom one is a command line window. And we have to unplug here. Okay, so that what I ended up doing is, okay, so your sound card has certain sampling rates that it can support. I'm also going over HDMI. For some reason, 8,000, my sampling rate didn't work, so I went to a CD sampling rate as a change. So here is again, we'll go over the MATLAB code in just a second, but this is just a very easy way to specify the frequency you want, F naught, a sampling rate used by the sound card, play out the samples of the cosine at a certain rate. And so what I'm playing here is 3 seconds, that's the 3 here, of the cosine at 440 hertz. And then what I did is I changed the sampling rate for the sound card to be 44,100. So I'll play that again. So that's 440. Can we close the door all the way back here? No. Is it all the way? It's already closed. Is it? All right. Okay, so that's how the sinusoid sounds at 440 hertz when you play it back. So here's another example. This is straight from the book. So again, when I'm taking a slide out of the book, you'll see it copyrighted in the left corner in the slide. So this is right out of the book. And so the book uses a tuning fork to generate the signal at roughly 440 hertz. Roughly. So we can figure out exactly what it is for measurements. So that's from the tuning. So when you strike the tuning fork, there's a lot of different things happening right at the strike, and then it settles down into the roughly 440 hertz. Okay, so if you expand out, so this is what the plot in time will look like in the upper left, and you'll notice that there's when the, you can kind of see when the hit happens on the tuning fork. Right? So it's a metal, looks like a fork, it's got two tines, you hit it, and you'll see a little bit of, you know, impulse there early on, about 1 millisecond, and then you'll see the ringing happen at roughly 440 hertz. So you can zoom into that and then try to estimate. And as you zoom in, there's, you know, this data is taken for sampling. So as you zoom in, these are the samples of the physical waveform of the sound. And if you're trying to figure out, well, what's the period of this, because then from there you can get the frequency, you want to find out, okay, where do I repeat? How many samples do I have to go before I repeat? Okay, and then so what's on the horizontal axis is how these samples map in the millisecond. So if I look at one period of the tuning fork, there are a couple ways I can estimate this. And I get very similar answers. Right? So one is, from the middle plot, I find, you know, peak to peak, or I could do zero cross, I could do peak to peak or valley to valley. Right? Or I could do zero crossings, but I have to go to 2 zero crossings to get a period. So lots of ways I can estimate what that period is. Or I can zoom in like I do on the bottom plot and realize, well, I need about 2 milliseconds and 2 more samples to get to back where I started. From the same amplitude here at 0 as I am at 2 2/7. Right, so from here, from the sample at 0 milliseconds, I need to go 2 milliseconds and 2 more samples to get the same amplitude value that I started with. One period. Okay, so that is, you know, 2.28 milliseconds. If I take the inverse of that, I get the frequency. So it's not quite 440, but it's close, 438, a little bit of error. The other way of calculating this, I get a 435. Okay, so let's start talking a little bit about MATLAB and the time remaining, and we'll pick this up for some Tuesday. So MATLAB's been around a long time. I first used it in 1987. So I tell you, a long time. So the first toolboxes or extensions were for control systems and signal processing. So the commercial version was somewhere between 84 and 87. I'm not sure the year on that. In 84, it was a non-commercial version. Okay, so here's some code on the right. Okay, so a couple of things here. So first thing to point out, if you just type in a command, you'll get the result of the command displayed unless you put a semicolon at the end. So if you want to suppress the output, you put a semicolon. Scalar variables, hopefully a little bit straightforward. I just have a variable like F0 equals 440, FS, which is a sampling rate, which is a higher number, 24 times F0 here. So those are the scalar variables, single real, you know, floating point value. I can generate a vector. This is really useful. MATLAB is really good at working with vectors and matrices, as are other languages. So here, we're going to generate a vector. And the syntax is, we'll have a start point, an end point, and an increment. Okay? So I'm going to generate a vector of values that starts at start, ends at end, and the intermediate results, I add this incremental value until I reach the end. So if I do start of 1, increment of 0.5, end of 3, I get the vector 1, 1.5, 2, 2.5, and 3. So it's inclusive of the start point and the end point. And when you break it down, that's really what the MATLAB code is on the right. The last piece of that MATLAB code is to plot the result. Okay, so we go through it. So I have 3 scalar variables, the frequency F0, 440 hertz, the sampling rate, whatever it happens to be. The sampling time is 1 over the sampling rate, just like the period is 1 over the frequency. They're inversely related. I tell it what values of time I want to plot. So here I'm doing 4 periods, right? The period of the cosine is 1 over F0. So this is 4 periods of the cosine. And then I simply type in the formula that I want, 2 times pi times F0 times t. T's a vector. So what it means is that this product 2 pi F0 t is a vector. Scalar times a vector is a vector. cosine applied to a vector, I get the value of each cosine applied to each value of time. So I get a vector of the same length that I started with for time. So now I have to do the last step here, is I plot time versus horizontal versus vertical. And that's the upper right. That's the cosine of 440 degrees, upper right. Okay, I'd like to start on time, end on time. Thanks for coming. See you next Tuesday.